This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky.
Happy birthday, Susan B. Anthony. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. My co-host Dan Barker is still on the road, as this is being recorded, doing a whirlwind free thought PR campaign on the West Coast, including three debates. Dan will rejoin the show next week. And welcome to the February 15th, 2014 broadcast of Free Thought Radio, broadcasting also in five other cities. FFRF produces this weekly show, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is also a podcast. And as you know, we're a national state church watchdog, the largest association of freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics in North America. Why don't you become our 20,101st member today at FFRF.org? And in a second, I'm going to bring on one of FFRF's five staff attorneys, Andrew Seidel, who's going to talk about the state of the law on creationism, and also we hope time for a dicey issue regarding ritualistic circumcision that he's just written a major complaint about to New York State officials. And then Andrew and I will have the pleasure of interviewing Professor Ronald L. Numbers, Hilldale Professor Emeritus of the History of Science and Medicine here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Professor Numbers happens to be author of a definitive history book, The Creationists, From Scientific Creationism to Intelligent Design. And it's a big week for birthdays, Darwin's birthday, of course, and today the birth date of Susan B. Anthony, traditionally celebrated by feminists with cake, affirming Anthony's commitment to equality. And I would like to note that Susan B. is one of 50 women freethinkers I anthologized in the book Women Without Superstition. She was Elizabeth Cady Stanton's faithful coadjutant and a good freethinker. And this is my favorite Susan B. quote, "Careful, cautious people always casting about to preserve their reputation and social standing never can bring about a reform. Those who are really in earnest must be willing to be anything or nothing in the world's estimation, and publicly and privately, in season and out, avow their sympathy with despised and persecuted ideas and their advocates and bear the consequences." So Susan B. Anthony also shares today's her birthday today with Galileo, born February 15th, 1564, and the great Jeremy Bentham, February 15th, 1748. And speaking of illustrious freethinkers, it was the 205th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth this Wednesday. He was born 1809, coincidentally the same day as the deist President Abraham Lincoln. And so we're going to talk a little bit about Darwin and creationism now with Andrew Seidel. And welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so to mark Darwin Day, you wrote a special piece. You want to talk about that?
Sure. We wrote an FAQ for our website and for our members to look at. FFRF has a number of these legal FAQs, frequently asked questions, you know, and we touched on creationism and what the state of the law is regarding creationism.
So we're going to get to that, but every year when he was in Congress, Pete Stark kept trying to get Congress to proclaim February 12th, Darwin Day, and since he's left, Representative Rush Holt has taken up the cudgels. And Andrew, you found this clip of him, Rush Holt, on the floor of the House on Wednesday making this appeal. So shall we listen?
Please.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to honor the birth of Charles Darwin 205 years ago tomorrow, and to call attention to a resolution I've introduced with a number of other members marking his birthday as Ceremonial Darwin Day. Through his work, Darwin discovered that the drive for survival of each species produces an evolution by natural selection. This discovery fundamentally changed our understanding of the world. It paved the way for innumerable advancements in the fields of medicine and technology and education. Without his recognition that natural selection enables increasing complexity, our comprehension of the world around us would be vastly poorer. But to me, Charles Darwin represents much more than a discovery or a theory. He represents a way of thinking, a philosophy. His approach to life and to the world around him should be celebrated as much as his discoveries. It was his thirst for knowledge and his scientific approach leading to new truths that enabled him to uncover the theory of evolution. This lesson is as valuable as the discovery he made and the explanations he gave. Thinking like a scientist is all too absent from our public dialogue, and this is why we should continue to celebrate Darwin as a master of clear, evidence-based thinking. We in this House would do well to emulate his vision and his thinking, and I urge my colleagues to join me in marking Darwin Day.
Well, hear, hear, Rush Holt. His colleagues did not particularly join him in making a proclamation for Darwin Day, but they keep trying. So, Andrew, for Darwin Day, like we said, you wrote an FAQ on creationism and the law. Do you want to summarize what that is?
Sure. Actually, this is one of the areas of law where the courts have done pretty well in upholding the Constitution. They've been fairly good at guarding the public schools from creationism injecting itself, or Christians injecting creationism into the public schools in all of its guises and forms. And this has been going on since the 60s, well, even since before that, the Scopes trial. But we lost that one.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people remember that. But the Supreme Court has been very good on it. Creationism can't be taught in public schools. You can't disclaim the teaching of evolution and say that it's just a theory or something like that. You can't put disclaimers in textbooks. You can't teach intelligent design, which is just creationism rebranded. And even these academic freedom laws that we've seen cropping up have been struck down. So, you know, it's a constant fight for us, but it's one that the courts are on our side with. So it's encouraging, at least.
Now, if someone wants to read the real state of the law, all the details, they can go to FFRF's website under legal, where we have a FAQ on legal questions.
Yeah, we have a lot of FAQs about all different areas of state-church separation, and we would encourage people to check those out when they have any type of questions about this.
But we thought it was very appropriate to post this on Darwin Day on Wednesday, and then also it was sent out as a blog, so you can also find it under the news link at fff.org. And what else do you, when we get issues coming in, what's the biggest problem that we're facing today?
In terms of creationism in the public schools, this actually kind of happens a lot. Just last summer, Rebecca Markert, our lead staff attorney, wrote a letter to every superintendent in the state of Pennsylvania pointing out that you can't teach creationism in the public school because, I don't remember the percentage, but it was something like
40%. There was 40%. A survey done by a newspaper that showed most of them weren't teaching it.
Yeah, most of them were just saying, yeah, it's, you know, creationism's okay, and that's my belief as a teacher, and it's okay to impose that on you as students.
And of course, Andrew, you handled the Ball State complaint out of Indiana, Ball State University.
Yes.
You want to summarize that briefly?
Yeah, we had actually a college professor teaching in his science class what amounts to creationism. And we asked the university to investigate. They did. Joanne Gora, the president of Ball State, issued a great letter on their stance on science education and teaching it. And then Jerry Coyne, an honorary board member of FFRF, who did really helped out and covered the issue a lot on his blog, was just awarded the Censor of the Year by the Discovery Institute.
Because of his role in Ball State.
So it was coveted award.
He put in his blog that he was going to put that award, I don't know if they're really sending him one, right next to his Emperor Has No Clothes award from FFRF.
Yes,
so that was cute.
It's very exciting, and congratulations
yes.
to Jerry Coyne.
yeah, I agree. Let's turn to, since the creationism, the law is with us, even if the teachers often aren't, let's talk about a more perhaps controversial issue, which is your letter that just went out this week to a whole bunch of New York State officials, including the City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. What is going on?
So there is kind of this ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect in New York that performs circumcisions according to their own rules. And the Mohel, or Mohel, is the guy who does the actual circumcision. After he cuts the foreskin, he scrapes it off with his fingernail and then sucks the blood from the wound with his mouth. There have been reports that children are getting herpes simplex virus from this. Of the 14 reported cases, 2 children have died and two have been given permanent brain damage because of this, and the rest are suffering with the disease for the rest of their
lives. They get debilitating rashes and pain, right?
Yeah, and pustules. And
do you want to explain first that, you know, almost every adult has herpes simplex. It causes cold sores.
Yeah, and the numbers are very high, but when you're infected at that young of an age, it can be deadly. And so, again, of the 14 children infected, two have died. That's a 1 in 7 chance, or about 14%. To give you an idea, if you were to climb Mount Everest, you have about a 2% chance of dying. Or if you were a U.S. soldier fighting in World War I, you had a 2% chance of dying. So you're 7 times more likely to die when you're infected with this herpes simplex virus through this.
As an infant. Yeah. Well, it's an open wound.
Correct.
And, of course, the fingernail scraping can't help.
No, it can't help the situation.
I mean, and this is a very squeamish topic and kind of extraordinary. But who did you write?
We wrote to just about everybody we could think of. The new mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, we asked him to take action. The previous administration had not been very good on this. We wrote to his health commissioner. We wrote to the New York Department of Health. We wrote to the state health commissioner, to the district attorney, because there are some laws on the books right now that could be used to kind of enforce this, child endangerment laws, laws that say you can't knowingly pass a sexually transmitted disease to another person. And we actually also wrote to the two senators, Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer, to ask them to stand up for these helpless children who can't stand up for themselves.
So this just happened on and late this week, so we don't know what the response will be. There is concern that people will not want to offend because it's a religious issue. So what would your response be?
Yeah, this isn't an issue of religious free exercise. This is about protecting infants who can't protect themselves. And that's what government is instituted amongst us to do. It's meant to protect those who can't protect themselves. And we need to be focusing on the harm this is doing and not on the ability of these parents to impose their religious rituals and their religious beliefs on these helpless children.
Because these are defenseless children, and it's sort of the same issue as parents who only pray and refuse to take deathly ill children to the doctor.
It's very
same idea.
It's very similar, and that's the child health care is a legal duty. Yeah, and Rita Swan's group, who signed on to our amicus brief for the Hobby Lobby.
And then we're almost out of time, but briefly, right now, the state of the law is that parents now have to sign a consent form.
Yeah, right now. So this all came up because there was another reported case. So the 15th child has been infected with herpes, and that just was reported at the end of January. But right now, the only thing that these parents have to do is sign a waiver saying, I understand that the risks to this disease, and that's it.
And in fact, there is a Hasidic group that is now suing over that, saying that the waiver itself is a problem.
Saying that just the informed consent is too much, and that's a burden on our religious free exercise.
Well, I think it's a very important letter and kind of utterly shocking. Most people don't know about this.
It really is. I mean, it's
what religion will create, what people will be prompted to do in the name of religion, you can never predict.
Yeah.
So I've been talking with FFRF staff attorney Andrew Seidel. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll come back with a little Valentine Darwin Day celebration in segment 2, and then we are going to interview Professor Ronald L. Numbers, author of the book The Creationist. So we'll talk about the history of creationism in this country and what to do about it.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. In Richard Dawkins' book, Unweaving the Rainbow, he makes a special plea to integrate science and art. And that plea inspired my co-host, Dan Barker, who's on the road today, to write a love song, a jazz ballad, that manages to do just that and also happens to be a tribute to Darwin. So it kind of ties in Darwin Day and Valentine's Day. Susan Hofer, a talented jazz vocalist in Madison, Wisconsin, performs this jazz ballad.
Thanks to Galileo for showing us a humble place in outer space. And thanks to Mr. Darwin for showing us the origin the human race. which means that our precious romance is mainly a product of chance. And these feelings of love so frenetic are just genetic. It's only natural that I would want you. It's only natural that you want me. A million years of evolution had its way, so we can blame it on our parents' DNA. I move instinctively in your direction. Somehow you signal me to turn and see. You will always be my natural selection, as a voluntary choice, naturally. That you want me. A million years of evolution had its way, so we can blame it on our parents' DNA. I move instinctively in your direction. How you signal me to turn and see. You will always be my natural selection, as a voluntary choice, a voluntary choice, my voluntary choice. Naturally.
Susan Hofer performing It's Only Natural, lyrics and music by Dan Barker, from FFRF's music CD Adrift on a Star, available at ffrf.org/shop. And you can look for a link if you want to hear it again. We have one up temporarily at our website at ffrf.org. Now, it's the passing of another era this week with the death of Shirley Temple. She was age 85. When I was growing up in the 60s, there were, of course, no videos or DVDs. You either caught a movie at the theater or you had to watch it when it was on TV. And for some peculiar reason, they only played Shirley Temple movies on the Late Late Show at midnight. So other children my age were being awakened early on Sunday by their mother to go to church. My mother was a different kind of mother, a different kind of parent, and she woke me up at midnight whenever Shirley Temple movies played, and I'd get to invite a friend over for a sleepover. We'd go to sleep knowing we'd get this very special treat of being up at midnight to be entertained by the inimitable Shirley Temple. So in tribute to her, here's a clip of one of Shirley's famous songs.
Animal crackers in my soup, monkeys and rabbits loop the loop. Gosh, oh gee, but I have fun swallowing animals one by one. In every night dark. When they're inside me where it's dark, I walk around like Noah's Ark. I stuff my tummy like a goop with animal crackers in my soup.
Goodbye, Shirley Temple. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. Andrew Seidel will join me in the second half of today's show when we interview our guest, Professor Ronald L. Numbers. We're going to be talking about Darwin again. He's the author of the classic history, The Creationists.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
And I'm Andrew Seidel, staff attorney at the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
And Andrew is guest co-hosting this week in Dan Barker's absence. And before we bring on our guest today, a creationism expert, we thought we'd set it up by playing a clip from the famous Nyham debate from 2 weeks ago.
What, if anything, would ever change your mind?
Well, the answer to that question is, I'm a Christian. And as a Christian, I can't prove it to you, but God has definitely shown me very clearly through his word and shown himself in the person of Jesus Christ. The Bible is the word of God. I admit that that's where I start from. As far as the word of God is concerned, no one's ever going to convince me that that the word of God is not true.
Time, Mr. Nye?
We would just need one piece of evidence. We would need the fossil that swam from one layer to another. We would need evidence that the universe is not expanding. We would need evidence that the stars appear to be far away, but they're not. We would need evidence that rock layers can somehow form in just 4,000 years instead of the extraordinary amount. We would need evidence that somehow you can reset atomic clocks and keep neutrons from becoming protons. You bring on any of those things and you would change me immediately.
Well, so that's, of course, the first one was Ham with the Australian accent, the creationist, and that was Bill Nye debating him. And that kind of sets the tone here on what's going on with the creationist debate. And on the phone with us from Madison, Wisconsin, is Professor Ronald L. Numbers. He's Hillel Professor Emeritus of the History of Science and Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's author of The Definitive History, The Creationists, From Scientific Creationism to Intelligent Design. And I want to welcome you to our show.
Glad to be on.
So before we start, you call yourself an agnostic in this book, is that right?
That's correct.
And to you, what does that mean?
It means that I am devoid of convictions.
On religion.
I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, but I also don't have enough faith to be a believer. So I'm caught in the middle. I think the questions I would like to answer, I'll never answer. And that, for me, defines what agnosticism is.
So you obviously had, as a professor of history, you would be very interested in the history of creationism. But what brought you to write this book? Why follow this so closely?
Well, I grew up in a family of fundamentalist ministers and attended fundamentalist schools from first grade through college. So
wow.
I was immersed in what's come to be called young earth creationism, and then landed up at Berkeley in graduate school in the late 1960s and started thinking more about these issues and thinking critically about these issues.
So you've been on the other side.
Oh, yes.
And in the 1980s, you mentioned in your book that you were actually wooed by two sides in a federal court case on creationism in Louisiana.
Right.
Is
the case in Louisiana for that, I was invited by both sides to be an expert. I went with the ACLU, but it was a very strange experience because whenever we would take a break, the lawyer for the creationists, the guy named Wendell Byrd, would take me aside and try to reconvert me.
And was that the Edwards versus Aguilar case?
That's correct.
That eventually became?
I mean, that's the major, you know, landmark case against creationism.
Well, it is, although there's no excitement associated with it because the judge issued a summary judgment. So unlike in Arkansas, where there was a full-blown trial, there was no courtroom drama in Louisiana. But it was the case that went up to the Supreme Court.
Well, haven't we had enough courtroom drama with the Scopes trial?
Well, it's all fodder for historians, so we like that.
And for H.L. Mencken.
There you go, right, yeah.
Well, so this book came out in 2006. It's kind of, would you consider it sort of the culmination of your career?
Well, the one that came out in 2006 was a second edition.
Oh, that's right.
To which I added about 150 pages, I think, and covered the intelligent design movement and what is surprising to many people, the rapid spread of creationism around the world.
So, well, we consider the United States to sort of have the black eye on this. You know, we're at the bottom of the list of Western nations, but you see this is getting to be an issue in other Western nations?
Oh, definitely. In fact, there's a book coming out from the Johns Hopkins University Press in a few months that looks at creationism in the various European countries.
And you also mentioned in your book that it's not just limited to Christianity. You have a small section on some of the more ultra-Orthodox Jewish sects that
Correct.
Are also pushing this. Could you talk about that for a minute?
Well, that's another one of the surprises, is the extent to which this fundamentalist Christian notion has been picked up by other religious groups, including the ultra-Orthodox Jews in both Israel and the United States, and more surprisingly, I think, by the Islamic community.
Oh, gosh. Now, this is the week, Darwin Week, but all of this, do you want to talk about how this got so entrenched in our country? Was that at the time that the Darwin's Origin of Species first came out, or was it the 20s, or what got it so entrenched in our country, the creationism lobby?
Well, I think you might refer to the creationists in the late 19th century as the silent majority. Many Christians were convinced that Darwinism was going nowhere and that it wasn't worth a big fight. But as Darwinism caught on in the schools and even in some of the churches, then it presented a real threat. And that's why the first appearance of public anti-evolutionism or organized anti-evolutionism in the U.S. Didn't break out until the early 1920s. The symbolic leader of that movement was William Jennings Bryan, who had run for the presidency of the U.S. three times and was a very popular orator. And he began speaking around the country against evolution and wasn't called creationism yet. The only thing the people who were opposed to Darwin could agree on was that they were against evolution, and they were particularly against human evolution. So the movements then were anti-evolution, and it wasn't really until the late 20s and early 30s that these people started calling themselves creationists.
So it's an interesting distinction kind of between the anti-evolution versus the actual creationists.
Right, and the key difference there is that even the fundamentalists couldn't agree on how the first chapters of Genesis should be interpreted.
Well, the first chapters of Genesis can't agree on how they should be interpreted, right?
Yeah. I mean,
no, we have woman created right away, then we have her created later.
And William Jennings Bryan believed that the days of Genesis 1 could be as long as you needed them to be.
Handy.
And that was not uncommon among the leaders of the fundamentalist movement. Most of the rest of them put the entire geological column before the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve. And only a very tiny group in the 20s, mostly contained within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, ascribed the fossil record almost entirely to the 1 year of Noah's flood.
So
you had three camps there. They all opposed evolution, but they didn't agree on a positive program.
Well, so let's contrast that with today. What's the typical creationist believe today?
Well, that's a very difficult question. Although, about 1970, flood geology young earth creationists adopted the name scientific creationism or creation science. And they have risen to the top. Whereas in the 20s, they were a tiny minority. Now, if you call yourself a creationist, most people will assume that you're a young earth creationist. So that although there are numerous people out there who continue to believe in the gap and day age interpretations of Genesis, they don't get much attention these days.
And one of the things that I liked in your book, too, is you also talked about the Dover versus Kitzmiller trial, the intelligent design trial, and that seems to be the latest kind of innovation in this creation science, or sort of the latest rebranding, this intelligent design aspect.
Right. I mean, there's been this fascinating history of first trying to outlaw the teaching of human evolution. And then in the late 70s and 80s, promoting balanced treatment where you teach both of them. And then moving from a creator God to an intelligent designer. And after Dover, it seems that the next great trial that we're likely to see is over teaching the strengths and weaknesses of evolution.
Well, I have to interrupt now. We need to take a break. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and Andrew Seidel is here with me today, sub-co-hosting, and we're talking with Ronald Numbers, professor, author of the history book, The Creationists, and we'll be back to finish up.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Andrew Seidel. And today we are speaking with Ronald Numbers, author of The Creationists, From Scientific Creationism to Intelligent Design.
And Andrew, you had a little statistic on the Ham-Nye debate.
Yeah, I was reading online this morning, and Christian Today ran an online poll, and they had 47,000 plus respondents to the poll, and 92% of them thought that Bill Nye won the debate.
Well, so that's a much better statistic than 50% of the adult population rejects evolution, isn't that, Professor Numbers?
Yes, I actually find it fairly surprising, because typically in these debates, the creationists win.
Now, it was an online poll, and the atheists do tend to rule the internet, so there's probably a little bit of a response bias there.
Right.
Now, during the commercial break, I asked you, Professor Numbers, I said I was surprised that you were in town this week and able to do the show because it's Darwin's birthday, and why don't you tell me what you said?
Oh, I just mentioned that I celebrate Darwin every day because in the state of Wisconsin, I have the Darwin license plate.
Well, and I'm envious.
As am I.
And I think we should all celebrate Darwin Day every day somehow.
Yeah. He's a great hero of mine.
And what we did at our office, I brought in deadly frosted brownies, which isn't very intellectual, but at least we had a little party for Darwin.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Now,
we need to remember him.
Yes. Now, what are we going to do about the sad state of creationism in our country?
Well, I'm a historian. I sort of diagnose what's going on, what happened, but I'm not sure that I have solutions.
Well, do you have insight into why creationists, why our nation is so dummied down that they, that 50% of adults claim they reject evolution?
After all, history repeats itself. So you have,
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the religious culture in the United States, and that a lot of people, a lot of Americans believe that the Bible is God's inspired work. We heard at the beginning Ken Ham saying that. And I think to a certain extent, the status of science has been degraded somewhat, so that people think almost that anything goes. Scientists aren't perfect. We know that. And so we can have, as some of the creationists have argued, competing paradigms, a creationist paradigm and an evolutionary paradigm.
That they're equivalent, that you can just pick your camp.
Yeah, they're both part of the larger scientific enterprise. And what is if you're in the area of science, what's especially scary is the attempt by the intelligent design theorists to change the very rules for conducting science. They want to resacralize science so that you can appeal to the supernatural.
And I think that's what we heard in that clip from the Bill Nye and Ken Ham debate. I mean, you have Bill Nye saying, I can change my mind if you present me with evidence, and you have Ken Ham saying, I'm a Christian, and that's it. And that's, I think that's one of the things that really... that bothers me about creationism, and that you're getting at, is, you know, there's this sort of reverence of ignorance cloaked in this certainty. And I think Darwin even wrote about that in The Descent of Man, when he said that ignorance more frequently begets confidence than does knowledge. You know, and then I think he went on to say, it's those who know too little, not those who know too much, who so positively assert that this or that problem will never be solved by science.
That's very good. I haven't had that good a quotation since I was among some Christians.
Well, Professor Numbers, do you think it's also that in our country, everybody, especially school teachers, are afraid of offending religionists? They're afraid of a big fuss being made against them teach evolution.
Definitely. That's a very important point, but maybe just as important is the fact that many of our science teachers don't believe in evolution.
That's right.
There have been polls in various states, and it's shocking.
The Pennsylvania poll.
Teachers themselves don't accept it. So they're not even going to be trying.
Well, in my opinion, you should not be a science teacher if you are not scientific enough to understand and accept evolution. I mean, it's a contradiction in terms, isn't it?
But doesn't that depend on what you think science is? If you think that science allows for supernatural explanations, then you might not have any trouble with that.
But our public school criteria should not allow that.
Well, I agree with you.
I mean, even
but what should be and what is aren't the same thing.
And even then, even if you bring in the supernatural, creationism doesn't really answer the question it claims, does it? Doesn't it just push the inquiry one step back?
Well, I think for the people who care about this, it does provide an answer.
Now,
It's not a convincing scientific answer by my lights, but for other people, they would find it quite palatable.
God said it, I believe it, that settles it. That's
right.
That bumper sticker you see.
Yes, indeed.
Now, one of those jokes that we can make about creationists is they don't believe in evolution, but they're continually evolving new ways to insert creationism into our public schools. Is there something new afoot that you know of, or what do you predict is going to happen?
Well, just before we had the break, I mentioned that you know, in the attempt to sort of find the lowest common denominator that might pass the constitutional hurdles against teaching some form of anti-evolution is the idea that we should teach the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. Now, that clearly, on the face of it, doesn't have a religious goal. We know that religion lies behind that goal, but of itself, it's possible. especially with the constitution of this Supreme Court. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few years or so we see a case coming up through the court system to test the constitutionality of the strengths and weaknesses.
And it could be out of Louisiana again with the Louisiana Science Education Act.
Exactly.
And I don't know if you've been following Zach Coplin, who's the student trying to repeal that, but there's a lot of good activism by students, but we face a very ignorant mass of legislators. Professor Numbers, people can find your book, I imagine, in all the bookstores, Amazon.com.
Well, certainly on Amazon.com. Probably not all the bookstores.
Published by Random House.
It's not available in most Christian bookstores.
Thank you so much for joining
us
today.
Welcome.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. I thank my co-host, Andrew Seidel.
It was a pleasure.
And I thank Dave McCann, our engineer. And you can go to fffrf.org/news/radio for archives of Free Thought Radio. You can sign up for the podcast. It's available on iTunes. Ask for more information at fffrf.org. You can phone 1-800-335-4021 or join us. And next week, we are going to be talking with the executive editor of Ms. Magazine about assaults, religious right assaults against women, especially abortion rights and contraception.
Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.